Panic flutters in his brain like a flock of small birds, threatening to obscure his thoughts. Ty fights to hold on, fights with grim intensity. If he gives in to panic, starts to holler and scream, he's going to be finished. Either the old man will kill him in the act of carving him up, or the old man's friend will take him away to some awful place Bernie calls Din Ta. In either case, Ty will never see his mother and father again, or French Landing. But if he can keep his head, wait for his chance. Ah, but it's hard. The cap he's wearing actually helps a little in this respect. It has a dulling effect that helps hold the panic at bay. But it's still hard, because he's not the first kid the old man has brought here, no more than he was the first to spend long, slow hours in that cell back at the old man's house. There's a blackened, grease-caked barbecue set up in the left corner of the shed, underneath a tin-plated smoke hole. The grill is hooked up to a couple of gas bottles with La Riviere propane stenciled on the sides. Hung on the wall are oven mitts, spatulas, tongs, basting brushes, and meat forks. There are scissors and tenderizing hammers, and at least four keen-bladed carving knives. One of the knives looks almost as long as a ceremonial sword. Hanging beside that one is a filthy apron with "You May Kiss the Cook" printed on it. The smell in the air reminds Ty of the VFW picnic his mom and dad took him to the previous Labor Day. Maui Wowie, it had been called, because the people who went were supposed to feel like they were spending the day in Hawaii. There'd been a great big barbecue pit in the center of La Follette Park down by the river, tended by women in grass skirts and men wearing loud shirts covered with birds and tropical foliage. Whole pigs had been roasting over a glaring hole in the ground, and the odor had been like the one in this shed, except the smell in here is stale and old and not quite pork, Ty thinks. It's, "I should stand here and jaw at you all day, you louse!" The taser gives off a crackling sizzle. Tingling, debilitating pain sinks into the side of Ty's neck. His bladder lets go and he wets his pants. He can't help it, is hardly aware of it, in truth. Somewhere in a galaxy far, far away, a hand that is trembling but still terribly strong thrusts Ty forward toward the back wall and the shackles that have been welded to steel plates about 5.5 feet off the ground. "There!" Bernie cries, and gives a tired, hysterical laugh. "Knew you'd get one for good luck eventually. Smart boy, ain't you, little Weisenheimer? Now put your hands through them loops, and let's have no more foolishness about it." Ty has put out his hands in order to keep himself from crashing face first into the shed's rear wall. His eyes are less than a foot from the wood, and he is getting a very good look at the old layers of blood that coat it, that plate it. The blood has an ancient, metallic reek. Beneath his feet, the ground feels spongy, jelly-like, nasty. This may be an illusion in the physical sense, but Ty knows that what he's feeling is nonetheless quite real. This is corpse ground. The old man may not prepare his terrible meals here every time, may not have that luxury, but this is the place he likes. As he said, it's special to him. "If I let him lock both of my hands into those shackles," Ty thinks, "I've had it. He'll cut me up. And once he starts cutting, he may not be able to stop himself. Not for this Mr. Munching, not for anyone. So get ready." That last is not like one of his own thoughts at all. It's like hearing his mother's voice in his head. His mother, or someone like her. Ty steadies. The flock of panic birds is suddenly gone, and he is as clear-headed as the cap will allow. He knows what he must do, or try to do. He feels the nozzle of the taser slip between his legs, and thinks of the snake wriggling across the overgrown driveway, carrying its mouthful of fangs. "Put your hands through those loops right now, or I'm going to fry your balls like oysters." Oysters, it sounds like. "Okay," Ty says. He speaks in a high, whiny voice. He hopes he sounds scared out of his mind. God knows it shouldn't be hard to sound that way. "Okay, okay, just don't hurt me. I'm doing it now, see? See?" He puts his hands through the loops. They are big and loose. "Higher," The growling voice is still in his ear, but the taser is gone from between his legs at least. Shove him in as far as you can. Ty does as he is told. The shackles slide up and finally stop at his forearms. His wrists stick up. His hands are like starfish in the gloom. Behind him, he hears that soft clinking noise again as Bernie rummages in his bag. Ty understands. The cat may be scrambling his thoughts a little, but this is too obvious to miss. The old bastard's got handcuffs in there, handcuffs that have been used many, many times. He'll cuff Ty's wrists above the shackles, and here Ty will stand, or dangle if he passes out, while the old monster carves him up. "Now listen," Bernie says. He sounds out of breath, but he also sounds lively again. The prospect of a meal has refreshed him, brought back a certain amount of his vitality. "I'm putting this shocker at you with one hand. I'm going to slip a cuff around your left wrist with the other hand. If you move, if you so much as twitch, boy, you get the juice. Understand?" Ty nods at the blood-stained wall. "I won't move," he gibbers. "Honest, I won't." "First one hand, then the other. That's how I do it." There is a revolting complacency in his voice. The taser presses between Ty's shoulder blades hard enough to hurt. Grunting with effort, the old man leans over Ty's left shoulder. Ty can smell sweat and blood and age. It is like Hansel and Gretel, he thinks, only he has no oven to push his tormentor into. "You know what to do," Judy tells him coldly. "He may not give you a chance, and if he doesn't, he doesn't. But if he does..." The handcuff slips around his left wrist. Bernie is grunting softly, repulsively in Ty's ear. The old man reaches, the taser shifts, but not quite far enough. Ty holds still as Bernie snaps the handcuff shut and tightens it down. Now Ty's left hand is secured to the shed wall. Dangling down from his left wrist by its steel chain is the cuff Bernie intends to put on his right wrist. The old man, still panting effortfully, moves to the right. He reaches around Ty's front, groping for the dangling cuff. The taser is once more digging into Ty's back. If the old man gets hold of the cuff, Ty's goose is probably cooked in more ways than one. And he almost does, but the cuff slips out of his grip, and instead of waiting for it to pendulum back to where he can grab it, Bernie leans farther forward. The bony side of his face is planted against Ty's right shoulder, and when he leans to get the dangling handcuff, Ty feels the touch of the taser first lighten, then disappear. "Now!" Judy screams inside Ty's head. Or perhaps it is Sophie, or maybe it's both of them together. "Now, Ty! It's your chance! There won't be another!" Ty pistons his right arm downward, pulling free of the shackle. It would do him no good to try to shove Bernie away from him. The old monster outweighs him by 60 pounds or more, and Ty doesn't try. He pulls away to his left instead, putting excruciating pressure on his shoulder and on his left wrist, which has been locked into the shackle holding it. "What?" Bernie begins, and then Ty's groping right hand has what it wants, the loose, dangling sack of the old man's balls. He squeezes with all the force in his body. He feels the monster's testicles squash toward each other, feels one of them rupture and deflate. Ty shouts, a sound of dismay and horror and savage triumph all mingled together. Bernie, caught entirely by surprise, howls. He tries to pull backward, but Ty has him in a harpy's grip. His hand, so small, so incapable, or so you would think, of any serious defense, has turned into a claw. If ever there was a time to use the taser, this is it. But in his surprise, Bernie's hand has sprung open. The taser lies on the ancient, blood-impacted earth of the shed floor. "Let go of me! That hurts! That hurt!" Before he can finish, Ty yanks forward on the spongy and deflating bag inside the old cotton pants. He yanks with all the force of panic, and something in there rips. Bernie's words dissolve in a liquid howl of agony. This is more pain than he has ever imagined, certainly never in connection with himself. But it is not enough. Judy's voice says it's not, and Ty might know it anyway. He has hurt the old man, has given him what Ebby Wexler would undoubtedly call a fucking rupture, but it's not enough. He lets go and turns to his left, pivoting on his shackled hand. He sees the old man swaying before him in the shadows. Beyond him, the golf cart stands in the open door, outlined against a sky filled with clouds and burning smoke. The old monster's eyes are huge and disbelieving, bulging with tears. He gapes at the little boy who has done this. Soon comprehension will return. When it does, Bernie is apt to seize one of the knives from the wall, or perhaps one of the meat forks, and stab his chained prisoner to death, screaming curses and oaths at him as he does so, calling him a monkey, a bastard, a fucking asswipe. Any thought of Ty's great talent will be gone. Any fear of what may happen to Bernie himself if Mr. Munshun and the Abala is robbed of his prize will also be gone. In truth, Bernie is nothing but a psychotic animal, and in another moment his essential nature will break loose and vent itself on this tethered child. Tyler Marshall, son of Fred and the formidable Judy, does not give Bernie this chance. During the last part of the drive, he has thought repeatedly of what the old man said about Mr. Munshun. He hurt me, he pulled my guts, and hoped he might get his own opportunity to do some pulling. Now, it's come. Hanging from the shackle with his left arm pulled cruelly up, he shoots his right hand forward. Through the hole in Bernie's shirt, through the hole Henry has made with his switchblade knife. Suddenly, Ty has hold of something ropey and wet. He seizes it and pulls a roll of Charles Burnside's intestines out through the rip in his shirt. Bernie's head turns up toward the shed ceiling. His jaw snaps convulsively. The cords on his wrinkled old neck stand out, and he voices a great, agonized bray. He tries to pull away, which may be the worst thing a man can do when someone has him by the liver and lights. A blue-gray fold of gut, as plump as a sausage, and perhaps still trying to digest Bernie's last Maxton cafeteria meal, comes out with the audible pop of a champagne cork leaving the neck of its bottle. Charles Chummy Burnside's last words.
Let go, you little pig!
Tyler does not let go. Instead, he shakes the loop of intestine furiously from side to side, like a terrier with a rat in its jaws. Blood and yellowish fluid spray out of the hole in Bernie's midsection.
Die!
Tyler hears himself screaming. Die, you old fuck! Go on and die! Bernie staggers back another step. His mouth drops open, and part of an upper plate tumbles out and onto the dirt. He is staring down at two loops of his own innards, stretching like gristle from the gaping red-black front of his shirt to the awful child's right hand. And he sees an even more terrible thing. A kind of white glow has surrounded the boy. It is feeding him more strength than he otherwise would have had, feeding him the strength to pull Bernie's living guts right out of his body. And how it hurt! How it hurt! How it hurt! Die! The boy screams in a shrill and breaking voice. Oh, please, won't you ever die? And at last, at long, long last, Bernie collapses to his knees. His dimming gaze fixes on the taser, and he reaches one trembling hand toward it. Before it can get far, the light of consciousness leaves Bernie's eyes. He hasn't endured enough pain to equal even the hundredth part of the suffering he has inflicted, but it's all his ancient body can take. He makes a harsh cawing sound deep in his throat, then tumbles over backward, more intestines pulling out of his lower abdomen as he does so. He is unaware of this or of anything else. Carl Beerstone, also known as Charles Burnside, also known as Chummy Burnside, is dead. For over 30 seconds, nothing moves. Tyler Marshall is alive, but at first only hangs from the axis of his shackled left arm, still clutching a loop of Bernie's intestine in his right hand, clutching it in a death grip. At last, some sense of awareness informs his features. He gets his feet under him and scrambles upright, easing the all but intolerable pressure on the socket of his left shoulder. He suddenly becomes aware that his right arm is splashed with gore all the way to the bicep, and that he's got a handful of dead man's insides. He lets go of them and bolts for the door, not remembering that he's still chained to the wall, until he is yanked back, the socket of his shoulder once more bellowing with pain. "You've done well," the voice of Judy Sophie whispers. "But you have to get out of here. And quick." Tears start to roll down his dirty, pallid face again, and Ty begins to scream at the top of his voice.
"Help me! Somebody help me! I'm in the shed! I'm in the shed!"
Out in front of the sandbar, Doc stays where he is, with his scoot rumbling between his legs. But Beezer turns his off, levers the stand into place with one booted heel, and walks over to Jack, Dale, and Fred. Jack has taken charge of the wrapped object Ty's father has brought them. Fred, meanwhile, has gotten hold of Jack's shirt. Dale tries to restrain the man, but as far as Fred Marshall's concerned, there are now only two people in the world, him and Hollywood Jack Sawyer.
"It was him, wasn't it? It was Ty. That was my boy. I heard him."
"Yes," Jack says. "It certainly was, and you certainly did." He's gone rather pale, Beezer sees, but is otherwise calm. It's absolutely not bothering him that the missing boy's father has yanked his shirt out of his pants. No, all Jack's attention is on the wrapped package.
"What in God's name is going on here?"
Dale asks plaintively. He looks at Beezer. "Do you know?"
"The kid's in a shed somewhere," Beezer says. "Am I right about that?"
"Yes," Jack says. Fred abruptly lets go of Jack's shirt and staggers backwards, sobbing. Jack pays no attention to him and makes no effort to tuck in the tail of his crumpled shirt. He's still looking at the package. He half expects sugar packet stamps, but no, this is just a case of plain old metered mail. Whatever it is, it's been mailed priority to Mr. Tyler Marshall, 16 Robin Hood Lane, French Landing. The return address has been stamped in red. Mr. George Rathbun, KDCU, 4 Peninsula Drive, French Landing. Below this, stamped in large black letters, "Even a blind man can see that Cooley Country loves the Brewer Bash."
"Henry, you never quit, do you?"
Jack murmurs. Tears sting his eyes. The idea of life without his old friend hits him all over again, leaves him feeling helpless and lost and stupid and hurt.
"What about Uncle Henry?"
Dale asks.
"Jack, Uncle Henry's dead."
Jack's no longer so sure of that somehow.
"Let's go," Beezer says. "We gotta get that kid. He's alive, but he ain't safe. I got that clear as a bell. Let's go for it. We can figure the rest out later."
But Jack, who has not just heard Tyler shout, but has for the moment seen through Tyler's eyes, doesn't have much to figure out. In fact, figuring out now comes down to only one thing. Ignoring both Beezer and Dale, he steps toward Ty's weeping father.
"Fred."
Fred goes on sobbing. "Fred, if you ever want to see your boy again, you get hold of yourself right now and listen to me." Fred looks up, red eyes streaming. The ridiculously small baseball cap still perches on his head.
"What's in this, Fred?"
"It must be a prize in that contest George Rathbun runs every summer, the Brewer Bash. But I don't know how Ty could have won something in the first place. A couple of weeks ago, he was pissing and moaning about how he forgot to enter. He even asked if maybe I'd entered the contest for him, and I kind of, well, I snapped at him."
Fresh tears begin running down Fred's stubbly cheeks at the memory.
"That was around the time Judy was getting strange. I was worried about her, and I just kind of snapped at him, you know?"
Fred's chest heaves. He makes a watery hitching sound, and his Adam's apple bobs up and down. He wipes an arm across his eyes.
"And Ty, all he said was, 'That's all right, Dad. He didn't get mad at me, didn't sulk or anything. Because that's just the kind of boy he was, that he is.'"
"How did you know to bring it to me?"
"Your friend called," Fred says. "He told me the postman had brought something, and I had to bring it to you here, right away, before you left. He called you..."
"He called me Traveling Jack."
Fred Marshall looks at him wonderingly.
"That's right."
"All right." Jack speaks gently, almost absently. "We're going to get your boy now."
I'll come. I've got my deer rifle in the truck.
And that's where it's going to stay. Go home. Make a place for him. Make a place for your wife. And let us do what we have to do. Jack looks first at Dale, then at Beezer. Come on, he says. Let's roll. 5 minutes later, the FLPD chief's car is speeding west on Highway 35. Directly ahead, like an honor guard, Beezer and Doc are riding side by side, the sun gleaming on the chrome of their bikes. Trees in full summer leaf crowd close to the road on either side. Jack can feel the buzzing that is Black House's signature starting to ramp up in his head. He has discovered he can wall that noise off if he has to, keep it from spreading and blanketing his entire thought process with static, but it's still damned unpleasant. He has helped himself to one of the Ruger 357s that are the police department's service weapons. It's now stuck in the waistband of his blue jeans. He was surprised at how good the weight of it felt in his hand, almost like a homecoming. Guns may not be of much use in the world behind Black House, but they have to get there first, don't they? And according to Beezer and Doc, the approach is not exactly undefended. Dale, do you have a pocket knife? Glove compartment, Dale says. He glances at the long package on Jack's lap. I presume you want to open that. You presume right. Can you explain a few things while you do it? Like whether or not once we get inside Black House, we can expect Charles Burnside to jump out of a secret door with an axe and start Chummy Burnside's days of jumping out at folks are all over, Jack says. He's dead. Time Marshall killed him. That's what hit us outside the sandbar. The chief's car swerves so extravagantly all the way across to the left side of the road that Beezer looks back for a moment, startled at what he's just seen in his rear view. Jack gives him a hard, quick wave, go on, don't worry about us, and Beez faces forward again. What? Dale gasps. The old bastard was hurt, but I have an idea that Ty still did one hell of a brave thing. Brave and crafty, both. Jack is thinking that Henry softened Burnside up and Ty finished him up. What George Rathbun would undoubtedly have called a honey of a double play. How? Disemboweled him with his bare hands. Hand. I'm pretty sure the other one's chained up somehow. Dale is silent for a moment, watching the motorcyclists ahead of him as they lean into a curve with their hair streaming out from beneath their token gestures at obeying Wisconsin's helmet law. Jack, meanwhile, is slitting open brown wrapping paper and revealing a long white carton beneath. Something rolls back and forth inside. You're telling me that a 10-year-old boy disemboweled a serial killer, a serial cannibal? You somehow know this? Yes. I find that extremely difficult to believe. Based on the father, I guess I can understand that. Fred's a wimp is what comes to mind, but that is both unfair and untrue. Fred's tender-hearted, Jack says. Judy, though, backbone, Dale says. She does have that, I'm told. Jack gives his friend a humorless grin. He's got the buzzing confined to a small portion of his brain, but in that one small portion it's shrieking like a fire alarm. They're almost there. She certainly does, he tells Dale, and so does the boy. He's brave. What Jack has almost said is, he's a prince. And he's alive. Yes. Chained in a shed somewhere. Right. Behind Burnside's house. Uh-huh. If I've got the geography right, that places him somewhere in the woods near Schubert and Gale. Jack smiles and says nothing. All right, Dale says heavily. What have I got wrong? It doesn't matter, which is good because it's impossible to explain. Jack just hopes Dale's mind is screwed down tightly, because it's apt to take one hell of a pounding in the next hour or so. His fingernail slits the tape holding the box closed. He opens it. There's bubble wrap beneath. Jack pulls it out, tosses it into the footwell, and looks at Ty Marshall's Brewer Bash prize. A prize he won, even though he apparently never entered the contest. Jack lets out a little sigh of awe. There's enough kid left in him to react to the object that he sees,
even though he never played the game once he was too old for Little League. Because there's something about a bat, isn't there? Something that speaks to our primitive beliefs about the purity of struggle and the strength of our team. The home team of the right and the white. Surely Bernard Malamud knew it. Jack has read The Natural a score of times, always hoping for a different ending, and when the movie offered him one, he hated it, always loving the fact that Roy Hobbs named his cudgel Wonder Boy. And never mind the critics with all their stuffy talk about the Arthurian legend and phallic symbols. Sometimes a cigar is just a smoke, and sometimes a bat is just a bat. A big stick, something to hit home runs with. "Holy wow," Dale says, glancing over. And he looks younger, boyish, eyes wide. So Jack isn't the only one, it seems. "Who's bat?" Jack lifts it carefully from the box. Written up the barrel in black magic marker is this message. To Tyler Marshall. Keep slugging. Your pal, Richie Sexson. Richie Sexson, Jack says. Who's Richie Sexson? Big slugger for the Brewers, Dale says. Is he as good as Roy Hobbs? Roy, then Dale grins. Oh, in that movie. Robert Redford, right? No, I don't think... Hey, what are you doing? Still holding the bat, in fact he almost bashes Dale in the right cheekbone with the end of it, Jack reaches over and honks the horn. Pull over, he says. This is it. Those dopes were out here only yesterday and they're going right past it. Dale pulls over on the shoulder, brings the cruiser to a jerky stop, and puts it in park. When he looks over at Jack, his face has gone remarkably pale. Oh, man, Jack. I don't feel so good. Maybe it was breakfast. Christ, I hope I'm not going to start puking. That buzzing you hear in your head, is that from breakfast? Jack inquires. Dale's eyes go wide. How do you? Because I hear it, too, and feel it in my stomach. It's not your breakfast. It's Black House. Jack holds out the squeeze bottle. Go on, dab some more around your nostrils. Get some right up in. You'll feel better. Projecting absolute confidence. Because it's not about secret weapons or secret formulas. It's certainly not about honey. It's about belief. They have left the realm of the rational and have entered the realm of slippage. Jack knows it for certain as soon as he opens the car door. Ahead of him, the bikes swerve and come back. Beezer, an impatient look on his face, is shaking his head. No, no, not here. Dale joins Jack at the front of the car. His face is still pale, but the skin around and below his nose is shiny with honey, and he looks steady enough on his feet. Thanks, Jack. This is so much better. I don't know how putting honey around my nose could affect my ears, but the buzzing's better, too. It's nothing but a low drone. Wrong place, Beezer bawls as he pulls his Harley up to the front of the cruiser. Nope, Jack says calmly, looking at the unbroken woods. Sunlight on green leaves contrasting with crazy black zigzags of shadow. Everything trembling and unsteady, making mock of perspective. This is it, the hideout of Mr. Munshun and the Black House gang, as the Duke never said. Now Doc's bike adds to the din as he pulls up next to Beezer. Beez is right. We were just out here yesterday, you damn fool. Don't you think we know what we're talking about? This is just scrap woods on both sides, Dale chimes in. He points across the road where, 50 yards or so southeast of their position, yellow police tape flutters from a pair of trees. That's the lane to Ed's Eats there. The place we want is probably beyond it. Even though you know it's here, Jack thinks. Marvels, really. Why else have you gone and smeared yourself with honey like Pooh Bear on a lucky day? He shifts his gaze to Beezer and Doc, who are also looking remarkably unwell. Jack opens his mouth to speak to them, and something flutters at the upper edge of his vision. He restrains his natural impulse to look up and to find the source of that movement. Something, probably the old traveling Jack part of him, thinks it would be a very bad idea to do that. Something is watching them already. Better if it doesn't know it's been spotted. He puts the Richie Sexson bat down, leaning it against the side of the idling cruiser. He takes the honey from Dale and holds it out to the bees. Here you go, he says. Lather up. There's no point in it, you goddamn fool, Beezer cries in exasperation. This ain't the place.
Your nose is bleeding, Jack says mildly. Just a little. Yours too, Doc.
Doc wipes a finger under his nose and looks at the red smear, startled. He starts,
but I know this isn't...
That flutter again, at the top of Jack's vision. He ignores it and points straight ahead. Beezer, Doc, and Dale all look, and Dale's the first one to see it.
I'll be damned, he says softly. A no trespassing sign. Was it there before?
Yep, Jack says. Been there for 30 years or more, I'd guess.
Fuck, Bees says,
and begins rubbing honey around his nose. He pokes generous wads of the stuff up his nostrils. Resinous drops gleam in his red-brown Viking's beard.
We would have gone right on, Doctor. All the way to town. Hell, maybe all the way to Rapid City, South Dakota.
He hands the honey to Doc and grimaces at Jack.
I'm sorry, man. We should have known. No excuses.
Where's the driveway? Dale's asking. And then,
oh, there it is. I could have sworn...
That there was nothing there, I know, Jack says. He's smiling, looking at his friends, at the Sawyer gang. He is certainly not looking at the black rags fluttering restively at the upper periphery of his vision, nor down at his waist, where his hand is slowly drawing the Ruger 357 from his waistband. He was always one of the best out there. He'd only won badges a couple of times when it was shooting from a stand, but when it came to the draw-and-fire competition, he did quite well. Top 5, usually. Jack has no idea if this is a skill he's retained, but he thinks he's going to find out right now. Smiling at them, watching Doc swab his schnoz with honey, Jack says in a conversational voice, "Something's watching us. Don't look up. I'm going to try and shoot it."
"What is it?"
Dale asks, smiling back. He doesn't look up, only straight ahead. Now he can quite clearly see the shadowy lane that must lead to Burnside's house. It wasn't there. He could have sworn it wasn't. But now it is. "It's a pain in the ass," Jack says, and suddenly swings the Ruger up, locking both hands around the stock. He's firing almost before he sees with his eyes, and he catches the great dark crow crouched on the overhanging branch of an oak tree entirely by surprise. It gives one loud, shocked cry, "Ark!" and then it is torn apart on its roost. Blood flies against the faded blue summer sky. Feathers flutter down in clumps as dark as midnight shadows. And a body. It hits the shoulder in front of the lane with a heavy thud. One dark, glazing eye peers at Jack Sawyer with an expression of surprise. "Did you fire 5 or 6? Beezer asks in a tone of deep awe. "It was so fast I couldn't tell." "All of them," Jack says. He guesses he's still not too bad at drawing fire after all.
"That's one big fucking crow," Doc says.
"It's not just any crow," Jack tells him. "It's Gorg." He advances to the blasted body lying on the dirt. "How you doing, fella? How do you feel?" He spits on Gorg, a luscious, thick lunger. "That's for luring the kids," he says. Then suddenly he boots the crow's corpse into the underbrush. It flies in a limp arc, the wings wrapping around the body like a shroud. "And that's for fucking with Irma's mother." They are looking at him, all three of them, with identical expressions of stunned awe, almost of fear. It's a look that makes Jack tired, although he supposes he must accept it. He can remember his old friend Richard Sloat looking at him the same way, once Richard realized that what he called Seabrook Island stuff wasn't confined to Seabrook Island. "Come on," Jack says, "everybody in the car, let's get it done." Yes, and they must move quickly, because a certain one-eyed gent will shortly be looking for Ty, too. Mr. Munshun, Eye of the King, Jack thinks, Eye of the Abala. That's what Judy meant, Mr. Munshun, whoever or whatever he really is.
"Don't like leaving the bikes out here by the side of the road, man," Beezer says. "Anybody could come along and nobody will see them," Jack tells him.
Three or four cars have gone by since we parked, and no one so much as looked over at us. And you know why.
We've already started to cross over, haven't we? Doc asks.
This is the edge of it. The border.
Apopanax, Jack says. The word simply pops out.
Huh?
Jack picks up Ty's Richie Sexton bat and gets in on the passenger side of the cruiser.
It means let's go, he says. Let's get it done.
And so the Sawyer gang takes its last ride, up the wooded, poisonous lane that leads to Black House. The strong afternoon light quickly fades to the sullen glow of an overcast November evening. In the close-pressing trees on either side, dark shapes twine and crawl, and sometimes fly. They don't matter much, Jack reckons. They're only phantoms.
You gonna reload that Rugulator? Beezer asks from the back seat.
Nope, Jack says, looking at the Ruger without much interest. Think it's done its job.
What should we be ready for?
Dale asks in a thin voice.
Anything, Jack replies.
He favors Dale Gilbertson with a humorless grin. Ahead of them is a house that won't keep its shape, but whirls and wavers in the most distressing way. Sometimes it seems no bigger than a humble ranch house. A blink, and it seems to be a ragged monolith that blots out the entire sky. Another blink, and it appears to be a low, uneven construction stretching back under the forest canopy for what could be miles. It gives off a low hum that sounds like voices. Be ready for anything at all.
Chapter 28. But at first there is nothing. The four of them get out and stand in front of Dale's cruiser, looking for all the world like men posing for the kind of group photo that will eventually show up on someone's den wall. Only the photographer would be on Black House's porch, that's the way they're facing, and the porch is empty except for the second no trespassing sign, which leans against a peeling newel post. Someone has drawn a skull on it with a magic marker or grease pencil. Bernie? Some intrepid teenager who came all the way up to the house on a dare? Dale did some crazy things when he was 17, risked his life with a spray paint can more than once, but he still finds that hard to believe. The air is sullen and silent, as if before a thunderstorm. It stinks, too, but the honey seems to filter the worst of that out. In the woods, something makes a thick sound Dale has never heard before.
Groo, woo.
What's that? He asks Jack.
I don't know, Jack replies.
Doc says, I've heard bull gators. That's what they sound like when they're feeling horny.
This isn't the Everglades, Dale says.
Doc gives him a thin smile. It ain't Wisconsin anymore either, Toto, or maybe you didn't notice.
Dale has noticed plenty. There's the way the house won't hold its shape, for one thing, the way it sometimes seems enormous, as if it is many houses somehow all overlaid. A city perhaps the size of London, folded under a single weird roof. And then there are the trees. There are old oaks and pines, there are birches like skinny ghosts, there are red maples, all of them indigenous to the area. But he also sees twisted, rooty growths that look like mutated banyan trees. And are these moving? Christ, Dale hopes not. But whether they are or not, they're whispering. He's almost sure of that. He can hear their words slithering through the buzzing in his head, and they're not encouraging words, not by a long shot.
Kill you, eat you, hate you.
Where's the dog? Beezer asks. He's holding his 9mm in one hand. Here, doggy, got something yummy for you, hurry and get it.
Instead, that guttural growl drifts out of the woods again, this time closer.
Groo.
And the trees whisper. Dale looks up at the house, watches it suddenly stack floors into a sky that has gone white and cold, and vertigo rolls through his head like a wave of warm grease.
He has a faint sensation of Jack grabbing his elbow to steady him. A little help there, but not enough. French Landing's chief of police twists to the left and vomits. Good, Jack says. Get it out. Get rid of it. What about you, Doc? Bees? The Thunder, too, tell him they're okay. For now, it's true, but Beezer doesn't know how long equilibrium is going to last. His stomach is churning, low and slow. Well, so what if I blow my groceries in there, he thinks. According to Jack, Burnside's dead. He won't mind. Jack leads them up the porch steps, pausing to boot the rusted no trespassing sign with its death's head graffiti over the side and into a clutch of weeds that close over it at once, like a greedy hand. Dale is reminded of how Jack spit on the crow. His friend seems different now, younger and stronger. But we are going to trespass, Jack says. We're going to trespass our asses off. At first, however, it seems they will not. The front door of Black House isn't just locked. There's no crack at all between the door and the jamb. In fact, once they're close up, the door looks painted on, a trompe-l'oeil. Behind them, in the woods, something screams. Dale jumps. The scream rises to an excruciating high note, breaks into a peal of maniacal laughter, and is suddenly gone. Natives are fucking restless, Doc comments. Want to try a window? Beezer asks Jack. Nope, we're going in the front way. Jack has been raising the Richie Sexton bat as he speaks. Now he lowers it, looking puzzled. There is a droning sound from behind them, quickly growing louder. And the daylight, thin already in this strange forest dell, seems to be weakening even further. What now? Beezer asks, turning back toward the drive and the parked cruiser. He's holding the 9mm up by his right ear. What the? And then he falls silent. The gun sags outward and downward. His mouth drops open. Holy shit, Doc says quietly. Dale, even more quietly, is this your doing, Jack? If it is, you really have been hiding your light under a bushel. The light has dimmed because the clearing in front of Black House has now acquired a canopy of bees. More are streaming in from the lane, a brownish-gold comet tail. They give off a sleepy, benevolent droning sound that drowns out the harsh fire alarm buzz of the house entirely. The hoarse gator thing in the woods falls silent, and the flickering shapes in the trees disappear. Jack's mind is suddenly filled with thoughts and images of his mother. Lily dancing. Lily pacing around behind one of the cameras before a big scene with a cigarette clamped between her teeth. Lily sitting at the living room window and looking out as Patsy Cline sings Crazy Arms. Photoplay and Film Facts had dubbed her Queen of the Bees. In another world, of course, she'd been another kind of queen. And what is a queen without a loyal, royal retinue? Jack Sawyer looks at the vast cloud of bees, millions of them, perhaps billions. Every hive in the Midwest must be empty this afternoon. And he smiles. This changes the shape of his eyes, and the tears that have been growing there spill down his cheeks. Hello, he thinks. Hello there, boys. The low, pleasant hum of the bees seems to change slightly, as if in answer. Perhaps it's only his imagination. What are they for, Jack? Beezer asks. His voice is resonant with awe. I don't exactly know, Jack says. He turns back to the door, raises the bat, and knocks it once hard against the wood. Open, he cries. I demand it in the name of Queen Laura de Loessian, and in the name of my mother. There is a high-pitched crack, so loud and piercing, that Dale and Bees both draw back, wincing. Beezer actually covers his ears. A gap appears at the top of the door and races along it left to right. At the door's upper right corner, the gap pivots and plunges straight down, creating a crack through which a musty draft blows. Jack catches a whiff of something both sour and familiar, the death smell they first encountered at Ed's Eats. Jack reaches for the knob and tries it. It turns freely in his hand. He opens the way to Black House. But before he can invite them in,
Doc Amberson begins to scream. Someone, maybe it's Ebby, maybe TJ, maybe goofy old Ronnie Metzger, is yanking Ty's arm. It hurts like a son of a gun, but that's not the worst. The arm yanker is also making this weird humming noise that seems to vibrate deep inside his head. There's a clanking noise as well, the big combination. That's the big combination. But that humming, man, that humming hurts. Quit it, Ty mumbles. Quit it, Ebby, or I'll faint. Screams seep through that electric buzzing sound, and Ty Marshall opens his eyes. There's no merciful period of grace where he's unsure about where he is or what's happened to him. It all comes back with the force of some terrible picture, a car accident with dead people lying around, say, that is shoved into your face before you can look away. He'd held on until the old man was dead, had obeyed the voice of his mother and kept his head. But once he started shouting for help, panic had come back and swallowed him. Or maybe it was shock, or both. In any case, he'd passed out while still screaming for help. How long has he hung here by his shackled left arm unconscious? It's impossible to tell from the light spilling through the shed door. That seems unchanged. So do the various clankings and groanings of the huge machine. And Ty understands that it goes on forever, along with the screams of the children and the crack of the whips as the unspeakable guards press the work ever onward. The big combination never shuts down. It runs on blood and terror and never takes a day off. But that buzzing, that juicy electric buzzing, like the world's biggest Norelco razor, what the hell is that?
Mr. Munchen's gone to get the mono.
Bernie's voice in his head, a vile whisper.
The end world mono.
A terrible dismay steals into Ty's heart. He has no doubt at all that what he hears is that very monorail, even now pulling under the canopy at the end of Station House Road. Mr. Munchen will look for his boy,
his special boy,
and when he doesn't see him, nor Burn either, will he come searching?
Course he will, Ty croaks. Oh, boy, suck an elf.
He looks up at his left hand. It would be so easy to yank it back through the oversized shackle if not for the handcuff. He yanks downward several times anyway, but the cuff only clashes against the shackle. The other cuff, the one Bernie was reaching for when Ty grabbed his balls, dangles and twitches, making the boy think of the gibbet at this end of Station House Road. That eye-watering, tooth-rattling buzz suddenly cuts out. He's shut it down. Now he's looking for me in the station, making sure I'm not there. And when he is sure, what then? Does he know about this place? Sure he does. Ty's dismay is turning into an icy chill of horror. Bernie would deny it. Bernie would say that the shack down here in this dry wash was his secret, a place special to him. In his lunatic arrogance, it would never have occurred to him how well that mistaken idea might serve his supposed friend's purpose. His mother speaks in Ty's head again, and this time he's reasonably sure it really is his mother. You can't depend on anyone else. They might come in time, but they might not. You have to assume they won't. You have to get out of this yourself. But how? Ty looks at the twisted body of the old man, lying on the bloody dirt with his head almost out the door. The thought of Mr. Munchen tries to intrude, Bernie's friend hurrying down Station House Road even now, or maybe driving in his own easy-go golf cart, wanting to scoop him up and take him to the Abala. Tyler pushes the image away. It will lead him back to panic, and he can't afford any more of that. He's all out of time.
I can't reach him, Ty says. If the key's in his pocket, I'm finished. Case closed. Game over. Zip up your...
His eye happens on something lying on the floor. It's the sack the old man was carrying, the one with the cap in it, and the handcuffs. If the handcuffs were in it, maybe the key's in there, too. Ty reaches forward with his left foot, stretching as far as he can. It's no good. He can't quite reach the bag. He's at least 4 inches short. 4 inches short, and Mr. Munchen is coming, coming. Ty can almost smell him.
Doc shrieks and shrieks, distantly aware that the others are shouting at him to stop. It's all right, there's nothing to be afraid of. Distantly aware that he is hurting his throat, probably making it bleed. Those things don't matter. What matters is that when Hollywood swung open the front door of Black House, he exposed the official greeter. The official greeter is Daisy Temperley, Doc's brown-eyed girl. She's wearing a pretty pink dress. Her skin is pale as paper, except on the right side of her forehead, where a flap of skin falls down, exposing the red skull beneath. "Come in, Doc," Daisy says. "We can talk about how you killed me, and you can sing. You can sing to me." She smiles. The smile becomes a grin. The grin exposes a mouthful of bulging vampire teeth. "You can sing to me forever." Doc takes a blunder step backward, turns to flee, and that is when Jack grabs him and shakes him. Doc Amberson is a hefty fellow, 260 out of the shower, more like 280 when dressed in full road warrior regalia as he is now. But Jack shakes him easily, snapping the big man's head back and forth. Doc's long hair flops and flies. "They're all illusions," Jack says. "Picture shows, designed to keep out unwanted guests like us. I don't know what you saw, Doc, but it's not there." Doc looks cautiously past Jack's shoulder. For a moment, he sees a pink, diminishing whirl. It's like the coming of the devil dog, only backward. And then it's gone. He looks up at Jack. Tears are rolling slowly down his sunburned face. "I didn't mean to kill her," he says. "I loved her. But I was tired that night. Very tired. Do you know about being tired, Hollywood?" "Yes," Jack says. "And if we get out of this, I intend to sleep for a week. But for now," he looks from Doc to Beezer, from Beezer to Dale, "we're going to see more stuff. The house will use your worst memories against you, the things you did wrong, the people you hurt. But on the whole, I'm encouraged. I think a lot of the poison went out of this place when Bernie died. All we have to do is find our way through to the other side." "Jack," Dale says. He is standing in the doorway, in the very spot where Daisy greeted her old physician. His eyes are very large. "What?" "Finding our way through. That might be easier said than done." They gather around him. Beyond the door is a gigantic circular foyer, a place so big it makes Jack think fleetingly of St. Peter's Basilica. On the floor is an acre of poison-green carpet, entwined with scenes of torture and blasphemy. Doors open off this room everywhere. In addition, Jack counts four sets of crisscrossing stairways. He blinks, and there are six. Blinks again, and there are a dozen, as bewildering to the eye as an Escher drawing. He can hear the deep, idiot drone that is the voice of Black House. He can hear something else as well. Laughter. "Come in," Black House is telling them. "Come in, and wander these rooms forever."